Friday edition of The Current. I'm Matt Galloway. A few thousand years ago, Earth's roller coaster climate hit a miraculous sweet spot for Homo sapiens. About 8,000 years ago, our species was released from the chilly clutches of the Ice Age. Friendlier climates encouraged Homo sapiens to farm, to gather in towns and cities, to develop economies, and to bring civilization into full bloom. But these huge advances in science, technology, and culture eventually ushered in a 200-year-long industrial age, an age that has produced so much greenhouse gas that the Earth could get jolted right out of its delicate comfort zone. My next guest is not the first scientist to write about what human advancement has done to sour this sweet spot for future generations, but his new book is garnering global attention from some pretty influential corners. Tim Flannery is the director of the South Australian Museum. He's also a professor at the University of Adelaide, and this morning he's in a Milwaukee, Wisconsin studio to talk about his new book called The Weathermakers, How We Are Changing the Climate and What It Means for Life on Earth. Tim Flannery, good morning.
Good morning, Matt.
I obviously want to get to what's in this book, but I wanted to talk first just about the cover of this book. You have some pretty remarkable blurbs from some pretty remarkable people: Ronald Wright, Jared Diamond, Bill Bryson, John Polanyi. The name that obviously stands out though is Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister. How does a scientist from Australia manage to capture the ear and the attention of Tony Blair?
Well, my book was sent to the Prime Minister of England, and he must have taken an interest in it and read the book and wrote me back a handwritten letter, which just astonished me when I received it, with a lovely endorsement and just saying this is so important. And boy, anyway, that was that's sort of on the wall, you know, framed. It's pretty special. So I guess that there is just increasing awareness of this, and people have been waiting for a book that just explains the science behind climate change simply, and I think that's what Tony Blair responded to.
You've also had an impact closer to home, John Howard and the John Howard government in Australia. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, well, look, the book was published in Australia in September and last year. And following publication, there was about 3 months of very vitriolic attacks on myself and on the book and on my credibility as a scientist and my ability as a museum director and whatever else. It was a pretty relentless onslaught, quite frankly.
What were people saying?
Well, basically that this guy can't be a good scientist because he believes in Gaia, and which is not true. You know, I don't believe in anything. I'm a skeptical scientist, you know, and that I'm not worthy to be a museum director for that reason. And, you know, the implication was that if you're an industry person, pull your support from the museum, you know, and that was pretty uncomfortable, I must say. Very, very difficult, in fact. But about December, our federal environment minister called a press conference with with our conservative daily newspaper in Australia called The Australian, and said that really he and the Prime Minister had been convinced by the science about climate change as presented in the book. And that was really wonderful for me. It ran on the front page, and immediately all of these these attacks just ceased. And since then, the debate has been about, well, you know, we've got a problem, what are we going to do about it? Mm. Now, that hasn't translated into a policy shift as yet, but I feel we're on a more productive track now than we were 6 months ago.
Now, you waded into this debate late. You were slow to get religion about climate change. You're not a climate scientist by training. What was it that turned you around? What was it that made you really want to dedicate a good chunk of time to this and actually write this book?
Well, look, I'm trained in paleontology and modern biology, and I have been aware of climate change as an issue, of course, through those, you know, my own studies for many, many years. But I simply hadn't understood quite how significant and large-scale this current climate shift is looking like. And it's interesting, a lot of geologists are rather sceptical about this issue, and I guess I was in that same camp. But then about 5 years ago, the premier of our local state in South Australia, which is like your provinces, asked me to advise him on science and the environment. So I had to put together a panel of scientists to direct state funding in these areas. And I thought I'd better just go back and make sure, you know, that I really had a proper grasp of what the key issues were. It didn't take me long reading the back issues of Science and Nature with that, you know, slightly different angle in mind to realise that that climate change was the big issue. And the more I read, the more alarmed I got, I must say. And I spent 12 months pretty depressed, quite frankly, about the situation, to realise that I had missed out on this and that this was such a major issue. And I'm not normally a depressed person, but towards the end of that period, I called on my colleagues to say, well, what are the solutions, you know? And as I started to look into those, I must say I felt much more optimistic. So that's the basic trajectory. And along the way, of course, I met many, many scientists and attended meetings and did more research myself. And the book really was a result of that trajectory.
This is a devastating book, though, and the evidence is so compelling. The picture that's painted is one in which the outlook for this planet is pretty bleak. How are you feeling as you were researching and writing and compelling the evidence for the Weathermakers?
Well, look, every morning when I got up and started the task again, I must say I found it difficult to get out of bed some mornings, you know, sometimes and continue on with this. And I did consider putting it aside just because I felt the message would be so bleak. But it was only when I got to that point of saying, okay, what are the solutions, that I realized that this is an eminently solvable problem. As bad as things have got without us knowing, that there is a way forward for this. And that was supremely important in my decision actually to sit down and write a book, to realize that there were solutions. And they were eminently achievable solutions. They're not sort of some pie-in-the-sky technology or having to wait for politicians to act, because we're waiting to hell freezes over for that to occur, I'm afraid, in some instances. But there's a lot that people can do. And that was hugely motivating for me to sit down and write this book. The other great motivation was I realized that as I was reading those science articles, what I was witnessing was one of science's great revolutions. You know, it was akin to the sort of revolution that the understanding of plate tectonics and continental drift brought to geology, and maybe even on the scale that, you know, that Darwin's thinking brought to biology. This is a huge revolution in understanding how our climate system controls life on Earth, and it's a revolution that's been occurring quietly over the last 10 years, and I realised I was privileged to have a ringside seat in this. And just understanding the science and how it had developed was, for me, enormously stimulating and interesting.
There's a line in the book in which you say that climate change has become a cliche before it's even been understood. And I think that's really interesting, because people think about climate change and they might not be able to point to specific pieces of evidence to say that this is actually happening. In doing the research, what was one of the things that you saw that was so compelling?
Well, to me, the most shocking moment of research was when I looked into what would happen to biodiversity in mountain ranges around the world. And the reason I say that is that the impacts on montane biodiversity, the science behind it is so simple. It's not complex. It's extremely well understood. And the impacts are just horrendous. Biodiversity takes a long time to develop, and mountain ranges don't last forever. So when you put those two facts together, you realize that it's often the world's lower mountain ranges that have the highest biodiversity, because they're the oldest mountain ranges. In Australia, we have an outstanding example of that, the rainforest-covered mountains of northeastern Queensland, where we have tens of thousands of unique species, which are, in effect, living fossils. They're things that have been around for millions and millions of years. And the climate projections for this century suggest that we might warm the planet by 3 degrees, be average, you know, if we don't reduce our emissions. And that would be sufficient to drive to extinction virtually that entire fauna, you know. So that is the jewel in the crown of our biodiversity in Australia. And you multiply that around the world to the other vulnerable mountain ranges, and you see this is a catastrophe of the most enormous proportions.
Now, the book is called The Weathermakers, and people often point to weather in particular as one of the signs that climate change is happening and happening at some pace. 2005 has been a hurricane season. There was a massive storm not so long ago in Australia. We're seeing Category 5 hurricanes across the world. What are we seeing there? Is climate change playing a huge role in sort of producing more violent weather and more violent weather patterns?
You know, when I was younger, Category 5s were extremely rare weather events in Australia. What we're seeing now is because the planet's warming, the atmosphere's warming, there is oceans are warmer and there's more water vapour in the atmosphere, and water vapour is hurricane fuel. And the total amount of energy expended by these extreme weather events, you know, tropical storms right through to Category 5 hurricanes, has increased by 60% over the last few decades. And that has meant longer-lasting hurricanes, more intense hurricanes, and those two impacts together are having a profound, impact on coastal communities wherever these extreme weather events occur. And, of course, we're seeing longer hurricane seasons, and we're seeing hurricanes appear in parts of the world that previously have been immune to them.
And yet this isn't an opinion that's shared unanimously. There are some scientists who say that climate change hasn't had an impact on the frequency and the severity of these storms.
You'll often find people, particularly in the US Weather Bureau, who'll talk about the Atlantic or the Caribbean area particularly, and say there are great cycles that can control hurricane activity there. And that is true. There is a cyclical nature to those events. But overlaid on that is this more ominous and more significant global pattern of an increase in the total energy budgets available to those storms. And that's what we've got to keep our eyes on. I mean, the natural cycles are not a problem, because they are a problem, but there's not much we can do about those. We can do something about this increasing volume of hurricane fuel in the atmosphere. And that's been driven simply because we want to drive big cars and we want to not think about where our electricity is coming from or how we can conserve it. And that is a bad deal, as far as I can see.
You mentioned Australia and the effects that climate change is having there within the mountain ranges. What about in the United States? You say that the U.S. is already bearing the brunt of climate change and will be among the hardest hit countries on Earth. What do you mean by that?
Well, the U.S. already has the most extreme weather events of any country on Earth, and if you just look at this, particularly the increased hurricane season, you can see what's happening in the short term to the Gulf states and whatever, you know, and that is putting a huge amount of pressure on the American economy. I mean, just in terms of the energy industries and the damage that's been done in the Gulf, the costs are large and mounting. And when you think about this as 2005 perhaps being what the average hurricane season will look like from now on, or maybe even a moderate version of it, It gives you pause for concern. Yeah. In terms of biodiversity loss here, if we think about the scale of changes that have occurred across this continent at the end of the last ice age, so at that time, of course, there was glaciers where New York and Boston are today, you know, and over 7,000 years, the Earth warmed and those glaciers retreated. It warmed by about 5 degrees Celsius, about 11 or 12 degrees Fahrenheit. Over 7,000 years. What we see today is a warming of about 3 degrees, 3.5 degrees Celsius for this century, over a century. So it's a very large change that is occurring extremely rapidly.
Given that evidence and that pressure, why aren't the governments of the United States and Australia willing to sign on then to the Kyoto Protocol, which seems to tackle at least part of the causes of global warming?
Well, there's four nations that haven't ratified: the US, Australia, Monaco, and Liechtenstein. And the only sensible thing I can think of is that we're waiting for Liechtenstein to move, you know. I mean, it's absolutely nonsensical. I mean, I do not understand what's going on there. It's in Australia's interest. We're going to meet our targets anyway in Australia. Can you believe that? We're going to meet the targets and we're still not ratifying. It is a form of political madness that's only driven by pride, I think, and refusal to admit an error. It is a tragedy for the world.
Is it driven by pressure from the fossil fuel lobby as well?
Very much so. And that's where the politics have come into it. But Australia is the world's largest coal exporter. We have the heaviest dependence on coal for electricity generation. We're making a lot of money from these fossil fuels and the export of them, and yet we're not willing to ratify the one international treaty that deals with the unintended consequences of that trade. It's profoundly immoral.
In the book, you talk about the work of Fred Palmer and how he has gone about preventing concrete action on climate change. Tell me a bit about that.
Well, Fred Palmer was CEO of Western Fuels, and he took it upon himself to produce a video which was very influential in Washington, which said that, in fact, that CO2 is a great friend to the planet. And they painted this wonderful picture of how crops would grow faster, world poverty would be eradicated, there'd be no more world hunger, all this sort of stuff, which was absolute rubbish. People like Fred Palmer have cost the world 10 years of inaction. We could have been moving at the Rio Earth Summit in 1992 if it hadn't been for people like that lobbying the US government to make sure no action was taken. And if we had moved forward in 92, we wouldn't be seeing as much of these devastating consequences that we're seeing today. We'd be on a much more sustainable trajectory. As it is, we've lost nearly 15 years of invaluable time, and which makes it so important that we start moving now.
Some of those consequences are seen in Darfur. You write about how the crisis in Darfur is connected directly to climate change. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, when I was a kid growing up in Australia, the crisis had already started then in the 70s. And it was inevitably portrayed as a crisis that was brought about by land mismanagement, that these ignorant and primitive people, was sort of the general impression you got, you know, had overgrazed their land and caused a changing climate that was now having a negative impact on them. Mm. In fact, that is not true at any level. What we see now with the recent science that's been done very rigorously to try to understand what's caused the decrease in rainfall is that it's occurring because of increased sea surface temperatures in the Indian Ocean. That accounts for about half of the rainfall decrease. The other half is caused by particulate pollution over Europe. So, you know, it's that comforting message that this was somehow a problem caused by these people, brought on them by themselves, by their own actions, is simply not true. It's been misrepresented.
You mentioned earlier the Gaia philosophy, which was created by the scientist James Lovelock. He has been saying that essentially we're toast, that this is very bad news, and there's not much that we could do to turn this ship around. Is that an opinion that you share, that we're beyond that point of no return?
No, it is not an opinion I share. No, I should just say that James Lovelock is a much valued colleague and I think has done extraordinary things in his life. My view is that we still have probably 10 to 20 years within which to act to reduce this pollution burden in the atmosphere and set us on a sustainable path. And the thing about it, I find, is that it is actually so easy. It's not like dealing with other environmental issues where you've got to wait for government to act. You can do a lot yourself.
But you set out various predictions of what the climate might look like down the road. What are we looking at in the short term and then in the long term?
Well, this is a very hard question to answer because anyone who tries to predict the future is almost certain to be wrong. But could I just say that we could face a large climatic shift, an abrupt climatic shift, which may be something like the shutting down of the Gulf Stream, you know. But if we set those possibilities aside and just assume that the trends we're observing at the moment continue on roughly the trajectory they're on into the middle or towards the end of the century, here's some of the things that I worry about. Rising sea level, I think, is something which is much underappreciated in its capacity to damage our global civilization. The last time the Earth was as hot as it's projected to be by around the middle of this century, our sea levels were 4 meters higher than they are today. So, sea levels may not rise by that much over this century, but it is a possibility. And if you think about what that would mean for port infrastructure around the world and the impacts that would have on international trade, you can see how devastating this would be. Trillions and trillions of dollars would be spent just trying to keep our ports open, much less worrying about seaside housing and the cities of the world that are vulnerable to these sort of, to that sort of rise in sea level. At the same time, if we're having more extreme weather events, you can imagine the stress that would put on the system. And then changes in rainfall patterns. So cities all of a sudden having to face a water crisis, which every major city in Australia is facing today.
If as we mentioned, Australia won't sign on to the Kyoto Protocol, if the United States won't, and they decide to go and form their own group, as they have this sort of group of six with Japan, South Korea, India, and China, what does that say about the will of the major powers to actually tackle this problem head on?
Well, the group of six has just become a farce. There are no targets. There are no there's very little new funding, and there's no timelines involved in their emissions reduction strategy. So it's laughable. It's simply not appropriate to be doing at this point in time. What the US and Australia should be doing is introducing a broad-based revenue-neutral carbon tax, which will redirect investment into those areas of the economy that will start addressing this problem very, very swiftly. The US free market is one of the most powerful tools we have as a species in order to address this problem, and it needs to be directed as to how that should occur. When I say a broad-based carbon tax, I mean one that covers right across economy and society. Revenue neutral means that we should offset that tax by reductions in unproductive taxes, maybe employment tax and that sort of thing.
Do you honestly believe, though, that there's the will for that?
Well, people are calling for it, people within industry. Paul Anderson, who is the CEO and president of Duke Energy, I think it's America's largest energy company, has recently called for the introduction of such a carbon tax, So there's the people who'll be paying, calling for the tax, because they realise there is no future in the way they're going. I've just come through Europe before I came to North America and see the enormous investments being made in by many European countries. Denmark has pioneered the wind industry. That's growing at 20% per annum at the moment, bringing enormous wealth to Denmark. They're investing some of that wealth now in developing the new enzymes that will be required to create the biofuels of the future. And, you know, I think American industry can see themselves losing out. They've seen what's happened to the car industry that's sat still on this issue, and the energy sector will be next. You know, this enormous revolution that's happening in terms of the way we generate our energy and power our economy will be very similar to the impact that the internet brought to many media. You know, players will be brought into competition which were previously isolated. You know, monopolies are going to be broken down, and we'll see a radical reorganisation of things. People are aware of this, and they want their government, I think at least the forward-thinking ones, want their government to act to pre-position them to take advantage of the situation.
But you also call, in terms of generation, for more nuclear plants online. A lot of people would say that that's a pretty risky trade-off in terms of creating lower carbon emissions to go towards nuclear energy.
Look, it is a risky trade-off, and I've called for more nuclear power in a very limited area. What I think is that the emerging economies of China and India have very few other options available to them. We've seen China now try to produce a new gas initiative. They've spent billions and billions of dollars on gas infrastructure and buying gas. The price of gas has now risen so high that a lot of that infrastructure is standing underutilized. China's built, they're damming every river in the country for hydropower. They're building the world's biggest wind farm, and they still can't produce the power they need to keep the economy going. They've also, interestingly, developed some very innovative new nuclear technologies, including pebble bed reactors, and these are reactors that are small in scale. They're subcritical, so they can't implode, blow up, melt down, or whatever you want to say. They look to me to be relatively safe.
They still generate the same waste, though, don't they?
Exactly. There is the waste problem, and there is the security problem, and making sure that nuclear materials don't fall into the wrong hands. And I readily admit that is a big risk. But what else are we to do? Are we to allow China or endorse China to continue building coal-fired power plants that we know will cook the planet, or accept this risk?
You end the weathermakers by pointing individuals towards things that they can do in their own lives. Now, I wanted to ask what you, as somebody who has studied this and written the book on this, has done in your own life to reduce emissions.
Well, look, I woke up one morning realizing that I needed to do something. This was a few years ago now, and I went out and bought solar panels and put them on the roof of the house, and now I don't rely on grid power at all for running all of my gadgets.
So you're right off the grid.
Yeah, off the grid, yeah, which is wonderful. And the kids have learnt how much power it takes to run a computer or a television or whatever else, and it's been absolutely fine. I had a government fleet vehicle, which was a six-cylinder clanker. I've just got rid of that and got myself a hybrid fuel car. I've asked my publisher to offset the costs of travel, the carbon costs of travel, when I go around the world. And whenever I go on holidays now, I'm going to do exactly the same thing.
I was going to say, because you're on a book tour now, it must be difficult to be talking about climate change, and yet you're flying around the world and driving in cars.
Yeah, I'm painfully aware of that. And when I come to Canada, I'll only be in hybrids, which is wonderful. Here in the US, it's a little bit more difficult to organise. But I'm doing what I can. And, of course, I'm advising the state government on these issues, and that's been pretty successful. In South Australia, 4 years ago, we had no wind energy. We've now 8% of the wind energy, of our total electricity, comes from wind.
Now, you're going to be coming to Canada in April by hybrid automobile.
Yes.
You're going to be meeting with some political leaders, including the Environment Minister, Rona Ambrose. The Canadian government doesn't seem particularly enamored of Kyoto, has given some signals that perhaps that isn't the way that the Canadian government will go. What are you hoping for in this meeting with our environment minister?
It's fairly evident that if Canada drops out of Kyoto, enormous damage will be done internationally to the treaty.
How so?
Well, you would have to say, you know, there's a number of other countries around the world that are having enormous difficulties making their targets. And wouldn't a temptation for them to be to say, oh, look, this is all just too hard, let's forget it, you know? And when we come to the second phase of Kyoto, which is the critical phase starting in 2012, you'd have to say, well, why would China and India, you know, make the enormous efforts that need to be made to limit their emissions when affluent countries such as Canada have just thumbed their nose at the world? And, you know, for those who criticise Kyoto, and I admit it's far from perfect, you know, we've just got to say there's two questions. What do you propose to replace it with, and how do you propose to gain the support of the international community for your particular initiative? And unless people can answer those two questions, I can't understand where we will go. you know, how we will move forward.
Tim Flannery, it's a pleasure to talk to you. This is a depressing and uplifting book at the same time. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Bye now.
Been a pleasure.
Tim Flannery, the author of the best-selling book, The Weathermakers, How We Are Changing the Climate and What It Means for Life on Earth. He spoke to us from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
From the Canadian program The Current, April 7th, 2006, available from www.cbc.ca/thecurrent.